This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Good afternoon, Tanya.
Hey, Talia.
How are things going today?
Not bad.
Not bad. I hope everything's going great for everybody listening right now. I want to thank you guys for tuning back into this week's exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. If you haven't done so already, take a second to look at your app and hit the subscribe or follow button because that does really help us. And with that being said, today I got a story on a serial killer that I don't think you've ever heard before. I had never heard before, and I went to Michigan State University, which is where the serial killer got his victims. Go green.
Go white.
Thank you, Tanya. MSU. That being said, are you ready?
Always.
Let's do it. So this story starts out in 1977. There were two friends named Earl and Gerald. And on October 20th, they decided to spend the day hunting for pheasants in the woods of Bath Township. You remember Bath?
Oh, yeah. That episode was disturbing.
That's one of our Patreon episodes on the massacre. But anyway, Bath is about 10 miles from Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. Love MSU. Sorry. I'll move on. It was around 1:30 in the afternoon when Earl spotted clothing in the grass and the underbrush. It was only a few inches from his feet. What struck him as odd was the way the clothes were laid out. It was almost as if a body had been there and then just disappeared. As I said, by his feet, there was this woman's blue ski coat and it had a fur collar. Inside the winter coat was a blue turtleneck, and inside the turtleneck was an off-white crew neck t-shirt. And inside the t-shirt was an unhooked bra. Where someone's neck would be, a green scarf was laying. There was a tree sapling growing through the green scarf, so it had obviously been there a while. Now, at the coat's waistline lay a pair of orange and red plaid pants. The pants were tattered. They'd clearly been affected by the outside elements. Inside the pants, perfectly inside the pants, was a pair of pantyhose that extended all the way down out the pant legs. Grass had grown over the toes of the nylons. Now, inside the pantyhose was a pair of white cotton panties, exactly where someone's underwear would be. At the end of the coat sleeves, there were some turquoise mittens, and a pair of shoes lay at the end of the pant legs next to the nylons. So you see, it's literally as if someone
just vaporized.
Yes. A few feet away from the clothing, the two men spotted a woman's purse. As they examined the purse's content, they found this leather wallet had a driver's license in it. The license belonged to someone named Martha Sue Young. It took only a few seconds for the light bulb to go off in Earl's head. He remembered that name from news reports. Martha Young was a missing 19-year-old Michigan State University co-ed, and she had disappeared about 10 months earlier on New Year's Eve. What Earl didn't know was that Martha was the first of four victims of a serial killer stalking the young women of East Lansing, Michigan. Now, I didn't go there until about 18 years later, and I'd never heard this story. I'm going to give you just a little background on Martha. She graduated from East Lansing High School a few years earlier. She'd gone on to college at Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. And she made the dean's list. She was very intelligent. After the first year of college, Martha came home to East Lansing for summer vacation. She spent most of her time involved with the church and its youth programs. During that summer, she met a young MSU college student named Don Miller at Bible study. The two began dating, but their dates were usually just centered around church activities. When summer ended, Martha returned to start her sophomore year at the Southwestern University in Texas. After two more semesters there, she grew really homesick, and she ended up going back to Michigan and applying to go to Michigan State University. She rekindled her romance with Don Miller, and the two became engaged in November of that year. At first, Martha was elated to be engaged, but that wore off, and she began to have her doubts about getting married. She's only 19 years old, and her and Don were very different. Martha was really outgoing. She enjoyed hanging around her friends, and she really wanted to embrace the student life at MSU. Don was more introverted, and he didn't really have many friends, and he was much more religious than Martha. After speaking with friends and family, Martha decided to call off the engagement. She broke the news to Don on December 29th. Surprisingly, Don wasn't that upset about it. And after the two talked, they agreed that they were better off as friends, which is basically what they were. Because of their religion, they weren't very sexual. Not that you can't be religious and be sexual, but you get what I'm saying.
I get what you're saying.
On New Year's Eve, Martha and Don, as I said, they're friends, they made plans to go out dancing that night. However, when Martha called to make reservations, she was told the place was already booked. Instead of going dancing, Martha agreed to babysit some children of a couple she went to church with. Don joined her, and they started watching this movie from 1963 called It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World.
I've seen that movie.
You have?
Yes, it's funny.
It is?
Mm-hmm. There's lots of well-known comedians in it.
Oh, well, that's what they were watching. Eventually, the parents returned home, and Don and Martha left. They decided to rein in the new year by finishing their movie at Don's parents' house, eating some pizza, and drinking some 7-Up with Don's mom. Exactly as I would do when I was 19.
Wait,
I wouldn't. I would have had a lot of vodka. And my mom wouldn't have been there.
Right.
But kudos to them. Around 11:30, Martha and Don left. They decided to drive around and look at Christmas lights.
Oh, they're so cute.
I know, they're so cute. But again, I would have been shit-faced by then, I'm sure.
It's so wholesome.
Around 1 a.m., Martha's mom, her name was Sue, she returned home from a late-night potluck dinner party that she had gone to with some of her friends from church. She was surprised when she got home to see that neither Martha or her other daughter, Kay, neither one were in their rooms. They weren't home. She waited for her daughters to return, but eventually she fell asleep before they did. When she woke up the next morning, she went to Kay's bedroom and she found Kay sleeping there. But when she went to Martha's room, she was stunned to find it empty. She knew in that instant her daughter was dead.
Wow.
Her gut just told her so. In a panic, Sue called Don's parents, and they, along with Don, immediately rushed over her house. Together, the group decided they needed to call the police. When the police came, obviously the first person they were going to question is Don Miller. Don tells him the events of the night, looking at Christmas lights. He says that he didn't drop Martha off until about 2 a.m. In her driveway, he gave her a kiss goodbye. She got out of the car, but she didn't go directly into the house. Instead, she sat on the edge of one of the porch steps and waved to him as he left. Now, the police were skeptical of this because it was 11 degrees outside.
I was going to say, it's pretty cold in January.
It's shit cold.
Mm-hmm.
But Don explained that it wasn't unusual for Martha to sit on the steps for just a second before going inside.
At 2 a.m.
Okay, I'm just reporting, okay? Take it down a notch, girl. You don't know this case.
I'm suspicious already.
Don's mother, Elaine, she confirmed most of the events of the evening because she'd been with them till at least 11:30. Police looked around the neighborhood for, like, footprints or tire tracks, but there'd been 16-mile-an-hour winds coupled with some snow, so everything from the previous evening was erased. Don agreed to let the officers do a cursory search of his car. When they did, they noticed some suspicious things. There were some scuff marks on the inside passenger door panel, and there was a small rust-colored stain on the passenger seat. The outside of the car had what looked to be two fresh scratches that looked like they may have come from tree branches. There was also sand and mud on the right wheel well. Don told the police that after looking at lights, he and Martha drove onto a country road and they parked at the edge of the woods for a few minutes to talk and to mess around a little. While they were fooling around, Martha discovered she was on her period, and so there was this small rust stain. Okay. The police officers immediately just focused on Don Miller. Their gut told them that Don Miller was responsible for Martha's disappearance, but they didn't have the evidence to prove it. And for his part, Don insisted he had no idea where Martha was. He had no history of violence. He had no criminal record. In fact, he was a former Boy Scout and was an assistant Boy Scout leader, plus a youth pastor. He started to feel like the police were harassing him, and he did cooperate with them for quite a while, but then he quit. He's like, I'm done. The case of Martha Young's disappearance grew cold until that October day that Earl and Gerald stumbled upon her clothes so bizarrely laid out on the grass. But even after that discovery, police weren't any closer to finding out what happened to her. But they kept investigating. 18 months went by, and then another female co-ed from Michigan State University turned up missing. Maria Choquette had already earned a bachelor's degree in English, and she was working on her journalism degree at the university. She worked for a while at MSU's library, and then she got a job as an assistant editor at WKAR, which is MSU's radio station. She was 27 years old, and she'd recently gotten divorced after only 2 years of marriage. So that's a little bit of a background on Marita. Now, I thought this was interesting. Marita went to the same church as Martha.
Really?
And she was very active in her church community. In fact, Marita considered the church's minister, his name was Reverend John Mittman, to be one of her really close friends. On the evening of June 14th, and this is 1978, Marita met up with two friends, Myrna and Rod, and they went to get a drink at Cork and Cleaver. It's a restaurant in East Lansing. Talking over a drink, Marita told them that she'd met a man at a tire repair shop, and the two exchanged phone numbers. She hung out with her friends for about 2 hours, and then they all went their separate ways. Marita drove back to her third floor apartment in Whispering Pines apartment complex, and that's in Grand Ledge, which is about 20 minutes away from East Lansing. When she got home, she made some small talk with a neighbor at around 8 p.m. as she took out her trash to the dumpster. And then she just vanished. The next morning, Willa Gritter, she was Marita's supervisor at WKAR Studios. She pulled in the radio station parking lot, and it's on MSU's campus. She saw Marita's yellow 1974 sports car parked under a locust tree. And this wasn't where Marita usually parked her car. Willa wondered why Marita was there, because her shift didn't actually start for a few hours. After going inside the building, Willa was surprised to find that although Marita's car was there, Marita wasn't. Then hours passed, and Marita never showed up for her shift. Willa called Marita's listed contact, you know, that contact people to call. She called Reverend Mittman and asked if he wouldn't mind going to Marita's apartment, maybe just to check on her, like a welfare check. He called her back a little while later and said he knocked on Marita's door, but no one answered. By the end of the workday, Willa's concern reached a fever pitch. And she ended up calling Marita's father, Henry. Henry, by the way, was an Episcopalian minister. He lived a few hours away, and he had no idea where his daughter was. After not hearing from her through the night, he called the police to report her missing the next morning. The police took Marita's disappearance very seriously, and they immediately started interviewing her friends and her family. After speaking with the supervisor, Willa, police learned that Marita came across as someone desperate for a boyfriend. Other friends of Marita confirmed that she was very lonely, and she spoke a lot about really wanting a man in her life. Enough where it made it into this story. After 2 weeks of actively investigating Marita's whereabouts, detectives were no closer to finding out where she was than when they started. However, that changed on June 27th. A little after noon on that day, Clifford Nichols, he was clearing rocks from a field on his tractor. After he finished, he headed back towards the road, which required him to go through a patch of woods. While he's driving through the woods, he's overcome by a putrid smell.
Oh no.
Assuming it was a large dead animal, he just continued on his little tractor through the wooded trail. Then he came upon a large pile of bricks and cinder blocks, and they really piqued his curiosity. As he approached the pile on a small tractor, he could see maggots and flies swarming all over the bricks. And the putrid smell became almost intolerable. He got off his tractor and he walked up to the pile.
Brave soul right
Brave
there.
Brave soul. On top of the bricks were these metal silo panels propped up to form a teepee shape. So you have these cement blocks and these bricks, and then on top of them is this teepee-like structure. There were some dead weeds that appeared to be covering up something around this formation. When Clifford pulled back the weeds, he was stunned to find a decayed human skull with hair still attached. He hightailed it out of there and he called the police.
How fucking scary is that? In the middle of the woods, alone, I would freak out.
Yeah, you know that formation just lends some creepiness right to the situation. When the police got to the scene, and upon close inspection, they could see the remains of a rotting body under the pile. After removing the bricks and the cinder blocks and the metal paneling, police found what appeared to be a partially clothed deceased female. But what really threw the detectives off was the fact that the woman's hands were severed at the wrist with near surgical precision. The missing hands were found a few feet away, hidden under some cement blocks, and they were found in what was described as a praying position.
Okay, that's weird. That just makes it even more weird.
The medical examiner arrived, and he concluded that the body had been there most likely 7 or 8 days, but perhaps up to 2 weeks. The police, of course, immediately suspected the victim was Marita Choquette. And to them, it looked like whoever killed her had built an altar of sorts over her body. An autopsy determined that the victim suffered 17 stab wounds across her back, her abdomen, her thighs. The cut on her back was over 9 inches long, and her cause of death was most likely from bleeding out. Dental records later confirmed, as you already know, the body was that of Marita Choquette. Some people began speculating that there was a connection between Martha's death and Marita's, and that the perpetrator was maybe a doctor or in the medical field because the hands were so precisely cut. Or perhaps a religious leader based on the formation. However, most of the police force dismissed any notion of a connection between the two women based on the fact they believed Martha's ex-fiancé, Don Miller, killed her. It's one thing to have upset ex-fiancé in the heat of passion kill. It's another thing to have some sort of ritualistic murder. They just didn't see any connection. As part of their investigation, the police gave Reverend Mittman a sketch of the crime scene and asked him if he thought the formation around Marita's body could be connected to anything religious in nature. He immediately thought of a book called The Concordance. Do you know what that is?
No.
The Concordance is a verbal index of words found in the Bible. So you can look up a word and it'll show you the passages that containing the word. According to Reverend Mittman, if you looked up such words as stone, hands, divorce, if you looked them up in that book, you would find passages containing accounts of severe judgments and punishments. To the Reverend, the scene seemed to depict a sacrifice to God. He felt the killer believed that God could forgive him for the murder by rationalizing that Marita sinned by getting divorced. That was the Reverend's take on the killer. Reverend Mittman gave them the name of a guy named Andrew Kensington, whom he described as a parishioner with a troubled soul, and told the police they should really check out this guy. A background on Andrew Kensington showed that 3 years earlier, he'd been arrested for assault and sent to the Kalamazoo State Mental Hospital. I used to live by there. Andrew was described as having an explosive temper and grandiose ideas of his own importance. He considered himself to be a genius. However, most people disagreed with that. By most accounts, Andrew suffered from schizophrenia, and occasionally he had delusions in which he felt he had a duty to kill someone. The police next interviewed Andrew, and he had some interesting things to say about the Reverend.
Oh, I can't wait for this.
He told police that Reverend Mittman was a womanizer who was sexually attracted to several parishioners, including Marita Choquette, and that he believed Marita Choquette had rejected the Reverend's advances. After speaking with Andrew for a few hours, police didn't believe that he was a viable suspect. They thought he was too incoherent, and his thoughts were so scattered that they didn't believe he could pull off a crime such as Marita's murder. So they were back to square one. On July 5th, a week after Marita's body was found, investigators were working on her murder when they got a call from the MSU campus police. The campus police were concerned that foul play may be involved with another student from MSU named Wendy Bush. Wendy Bush disappeared on the same day that Marita Choquette's body was found. Wendy was scheduled to work at the Union Hall cafeteria. Have you ever been to MSU?
Mm-mm. Nope.
Well, the Union Hall cafeteria is a cafeteria for everybody to go to at MSU versus having your own cafeteria in your dorms. Did I tell you I love MSU?
I might have missed that.
Love MSU.
So I could drive up there right now and just have a meal at the Union Hall?
Yeah, absolutely. We should. Do you want to stop? We just ate, but we can do it again. She was scheduled to work at the cafeteria where she had a job, but she never showed up for her shift. And that wasn't like Wendy. Wendy relied on her job to support herself, and she really needed the money. Friends describe Wendy as being extremely outgoing, very flirtatious. She was 21 years old, and she had a history of attaching herself to men who showed even the slightest interest in her. Apparently, she would talk almost compulsively to anyone she met. That actually cost her her job at Arby's.
Really?
Because she kept talking to the customers, nonstop. And it got her suspended for a few days at the Union Hall cafeteria because she did the same thing. I see, I don't even like to talk to people that much.
I know. I find that really difficult to do, especially strangers.
Yeah.
Just strike up a conversation.
Well, she had no problem with it.
I would find it incredibly difficult to do.
Me too. Unless I was drunk. Then I can talk to anybody.
Right.
Nonstop.
Nonstop.
Police interviewed Wendy's roommate. She lived in Case Hall dorm. According to the roommate, she last saw Wendy in the early evening of June 27th, the day I said Marita's body was found. Later that day, one of Wendy's ex-boyfriends, his name was Brett Wilson, he stopped by at around 8:30 p.m. looking for Wendy and Wendy's roommate told him that Wendy was out and about. Police questioned Britt Wilson, and he told them that after going to Wendy's dorm room and finding out she wasn't there, he coincidentally ran into her about 2.5 hours later, around 11 p.m., outside MSU's library. When he saw Wendy, she was talking to a man who appeared to be in his mid-20s. He was wearing pressed pants and a collared shirt. Britt spoke briefly with Wendy, and he told authorities that the other guy seemed to just disappear into the darkness of the night. To get a better insight into Wendy, the police went and spoke to her school counselor at MSU. This counselor opined that based on Wendy's personality, she suspected that Wendy was staging her own disappearance to seek attention.
Really?
Yes. But as the days passed and two of Wendy's paychecks went uncashed, Wendy's mother knew that meant one thing. Wendy was dead. And she was right. Wendy was the third victim of the MSU serial killer. Whoever this man was had a monster inside him. And 6 weeks after Wendy vanished, the monster was unleashed again. Like Wendy, 30-year-old Kristen Stewart lived in East Lansing, and she lived near MSU's campus. She was married to her high school sweetheart, Ernie, who owned his own building company. Kristen herself, she worked at a Catholic middle school as a science teacher. But because it was summer, she had the summer off, it's vacation. Around 8:30 in the morning on August 14th, Kristen dropped off her 1977 MG. I don't know what that is.
Me either.
Don't know, but she had a car. She dropped it off to Herm's Body Shop for some repairs that needed to be done on it. She was there at Herm's for about 15 minutes, and then she set off on foot towards a bus stop just down the way, and she was going to take the bus home. Now, you have to follow me on this. The bus drops her off on Coolidge Road, and as I said, it's just a few blocks from her house. See, I know the area, so like I can picture it in my mind. She's on Coolidge Road, and she's walking north. As she's walking, an employee of her husband, his name was Harold Duncan, he recognized her and briefly spoke with her at a stop sign. Harold then headed back to work, and Kristen continued walking north towards the intersection of Fair Oaks and Coolidge. So Fair Oaks is perpendicular to Coolidge, and it's a smaller street. And then Kristen lives off of a road, a small road, off of Fair Oaks.
So she's almost home.
She's almost home. She's just got to take a right. But Kristen didn't make it home. Somehow in that bright summer sun, she simply disappeared. When Ernie Stewart got home from work that evening, he noticed the doors to the house that he shared with Kristen. They were still locked, and their dog seemed unusually anxious. It was clear to him that the dog hadn't been let out at all during the day. By 11:40 p.m. that night, Ernie's concerns, they just overwhelmed him, and he called the police. He explained to them that there was no doubt in his mind something very bad had happened to his wife. They advised him to call back tomorrow if she didn't show up by the next morning. At 7:40 a.m., Ernie called them back. He insisted his wife had been abducted. After 8 years of marriage and having not spent one night apart during the marriage, he knew that the only reason she wouldn't be home is if someone prevented her from coming home. He was able to convince the authorities that Kristen was endangered, and by 9:30 a.m., they had helicopters in the air looking for anything unusual anywhere. Officers began canvassing the area where Harold had last seen Kristen walking. They found Kristen's sunglasses and one of her shoes in this grassy area near Fair Oaks and Coolidge by the intersection. Police openly speculated that Martha, Marita, Wendy, and Kristen may all be the victims of a serial killer prowling near MSU's campus. I mean, by that point, they were convinced there was somebody killing the young women, and they were all connected. Later that same day, the police held a press conference, and Ernie Stewart pleaded with whomever had taken his wife to please release her unharmed. A woman named Nancy Daniels, she was from East Lansing, She watched the press conference and she called the tip hotline to report something she'd seen earlier that morning. She explained that around 10 a.m., she was driving when she noticed a brown or gold car to the right on the side of Fair Oaks Road. And she saw what she thought was a man and a woman arguing near the car in the street. She remembered that the man walked around to the driver's side of the car. He paused for a second. He stared at Nancy, and then he got in his car and he just sped away. Nancy Daniels agreed to be hypnotized.
Wow.
That day, to see if her subconscious mind could produce any further details. And it did. During hypnosis, Nancy was able to give a much more vivid and detailed account of what she witnessed. She recalled that she was driving north on Coolidge when a brown car going the opposite direction made a quick left turn onto Fair Oaks. This caused Nancy to slam on her brakes because otherwise she was going to hit it. The brown car idled on the side of the road and the passenger door was ajar. On the street, a man and a woman were wrestling. She described the woman as having really messy hair and appearing very disheveled. Now, this all happened within seconds, by the way. The man then threw a kicking and screaming woman into the front seat of the car. He held her down with his left hand and grabbed a knife that was on the dashboard with his right hand. As a woman grabbed and pulled on her attacker's hair, he plunged the knife into her chest 3 times.
Wow, Nancy saw all of this?
She saw all of this.
Dang.
He then got up off the woman, walked around to the driver's side of the car, glared at Nancy as if he'd been caught in the act of something, and sped off. All that.
Wow.
And by the way, spoiler alert, everything she saw in hypnosis ended up being correct.
Wow. She got an eyeful.
And didn't even know it.
Right. She just totally forgot.
Yeah, isn't that so crazy?
That's crazy. The brain is an amazing, mysterious thing.
Well, we're going to circle around to some more hypnotism stuff in this episode.
Sweet.
Nancy described the assailant as being in his mid-20s. What was extraordinary about him was how ordinary he appeared. He was of average height, average build. He was Caucasian, had light brown hair, wore a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. Nothing stood out. He wasn't a three-eyed monster. This was about all the police had to go on, and they knew if they didn't catch this guy soon, he was going to strike again. But the killer was running on borrowed time. His inability to control his homicidal rage would soon lead to his demise, but not before he struck again. And we'll take a quick break. And we're back. 2 days after Kristen's abduction, a man knocked on the door of the Gilbert residence in DeWitt, Michigan, which is a small township near MSU. Since it was summer vacation, 14-year-old Lisa Gilbert and her 13-year-old brother Randy were at home during that afternoon. Randy and Lisa's dad and stepmother were busy at work, so the teens were there all alone. Randy decided to pass his time by fishing in a pond near the back of the house, but Lisa was inside when she heard the knocking. She went to the front door to see who it was, but when she opened it, no one was there. She walked outside the front door, and in her driveway, there was this brown car. She walked around the whole front of the house to the open garage. And in the garage, there's this door that leads from the garage to the kitchen of the house. As Lisa's walking into the garage, a man walks out of that door from the house and calmly asks Lisa if her dad was home. Although Lisa was a bit startled by this, she wasn't that concerned because their house was a new house. And throughout the whole summer, contractors had shown up to do odds and ends to finish the house. So it really wasn't all that strange to have a man around the house. The stranger then asked Lisa when she expected her father to be home and if she wouldn't mind writing down her dad's phone number for him. Lisa went inside the house to get a pen and paper. And as she did, she sensed the man's presence behind her. Suddenly his arm was around her throat and he was holding a knife. He led Lisa through the living room, down the hallway, and into her parents' bedroom. He forced her to lay on her stomach on the floor And then he got on his knees beside her and he removed her bra and her shirt. He put her shirt over her head so she couldn't make eye contact with him because he didn't like that, apparently.
Where's Randy?
He's out at the pond fishing.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
He's minding his own business catching some fish. Taking a pair of nylons that he found in the closet, the intruder tied her hands behind her back. He grabbed one of Lisa's father's neckties and he tied it around her head over her mouth as a gag. Then he went to the front door and he locked it. When he returned to the bedroom, he raped her. While she lay on her stomach, he then got on top of her back and he straddled her back. He placed the thin belt she'd been wearing earlier around her throat and then he tightened it. Lisa struggled, but she couldn't get a breath in. She could feel blood dripping from her nose, and it seemed as if her eyes were going to pop out of her head. As the attacker pulled tighter on the belt snapped into two, and Lisa's lungs filled with air.
Thank God for cheap plastic.
At the same time that happened, she heard the door that led from the garage into the house open. She knew it was her brother Randy, because every day at 3:15, her and Randy had to call their stepmom and check in. And it was past 3:15. So she just knew he was coming in to make that phone call. Randy walked through the kitchen and into the living room. And as he did, this stranger walked out of his parents' bedroom. The man grabbed Randy in the hallway and he held a knife to his throat, ordering Randy to lead him to his bedroom. And that bedroom was upstairs. After climbing up to the top of the steps with a knife to his throat, Randy decided to fight back and he started kicking the assailant. He caused the guy to become unsteady on his feet. However, the man quickly was able to steady himself and he overpowered Randy. He forced Randy into his bedroom and forced him to lay on the floor on his stomach. He then sat on Randy's back. He grabbed one of Randy's arms and he twisted it behind his back. And then he used this cold knife blade to slice Randy's throat.
Ooh.
But he didn't cut deep enough. And Randy was able to scream and struggle and eventually knocked the knife out of the guy's hands.
Wow.
It ended up on the floor under Randy's bed. The two wrestled, but the would-be killer positioned his arm around Randy's neck and strangled him from behind. Within seconds, Randy lost consciousness. To make sure that Randy was dead, the man grabbed the knife from under the bed and he plunged it deep into Randy's chest twice.
Oof.
Meanwhile, Lisa managed to shake the shirt off her head, and I don't know if I told you that her ankles were bound with a necktie.
Okay.
The necktie around her ankles loosened, so she was able to get them off. And the necktie that was used as a gag, that also loosened. So note to self, neckties do not make good bindings because they all loosened. She ran to the front door and she used her hands, which were still bound behind her back, to unlock it. Bloody and naked, Lisa ran from the house onto the street screaming at the top of her lungs. By the grace of God, two cars that were driving by, they noticed the battered teen and they stopped.
Oh, how nice.
In our stories,
never seems to happen.
Never seems to happen. In a frantic state, she told them that her brother was being tagged inside and she gestured to her house. Now, this is really cool. Not only did these two separate cars stop to help her, the drivers of the vehicles agreed that one of them should take care of Lisa and the other should go back to the house to see what the hell was going on.
Wow.
This good Samaritan named James Reagan was brave as shit.
Right?
Volunteered to be the one to go to the house. As he walked up the front porch, a man in his mid-20s casually exited the front door. James Reagan asked the man if there was a boy in the house and if the boy was all right. The guy replied, "Yeah, I guess he's all right. Why shouldn't he be? I was just looking for a fella here." Mildly suspicious and very confused, James Reagan asked the man to just wait on the porch while he went inside to check out what was going on. Of course, the guy did not wait right there. Instead, he took off running to his vehicle. Realizing that this guy was probably trying to escape James Reagan started chasing after him.
What?
He is a badass.
Wow.
But it was too late.
Wow.
The intruder sped off. But not before James Reagan was able to get the license plate number.
Yes.
Nice.
Nice.
As you say, nice.
Nice. He was thinking on his feet.
Yes, he was. The police and the EMT shortly arrived thereafter. And when they got there, they discovered Randy laying by the front door, covered in blood. By this time, James had gone to tend to Lisa. Randy's hands were over two stab wounds on his chest. Somehow, he'd managed to stumble from the upstairs all the way downstairs to the front door before collapsing. To their surprise, he was still alive and conscious.
Oh my God.
They assured him it was going to be all right. But in reality, they didn't really think he was going to make it. His clothes were drenched in blood. But spoiler alert, Randy does make it.
Oh, good.
He made a full recovery. Police immediately ran the license plate number. But keep in mind, they didn't see any connection at this point. I mean, it just happened between the four missing / murdered girls and Randy and Lisa. When they ran the license plate number, they were able to get the name of the owner of the vehicle. It was none other than 23-year-old Don Miller, Martha Young's ex-fiancé.
I knew it!
Yeah, it was Don.
I knew it. Son of a bitch.
Don was an interesting man. Sort of.
I bet.
Sort of. Well, actually, he really wasn't. He was dull and boring, which makes him kind of interesting, given the atrocious crimes he committed. Don had graduated only 1 year earlier from Michigan State School of Criminal Justice.
Really?
Yes. He was a criminal justice major, and he was currently working as a security guard at various stores. Don was an unlikely serial killer. I told you a little bit about him before. The Boy Scout leader, youth pastor. He came from a loving, church-going family. He hated alcohol, cigarettes, and drugs. He was a gifted musician who devoted all of his free time to his church, music, and killing. But there's another side to Don. I can't wait to tell you about it. It didn't take long for the police to find and arrest Don. And of course, he denied any involvement in the attempted it was not me.
It wasn't me.
No. But a search of his car uncovered some interesting finds. In his trunk were two camping tents, pup tents, a tow chain with a galvanized wire attached to it that looked to investigators to be some sort of strangling device of sorts. Oh. There was a disposable white jumpsuit.
Oh, that's odd.
Plastic bags. Rubber gloves, there were long strands of hair, and some blood stains in the trunk. Now, a search of his home, Tanya.
Oh, boy.
produced a few interesting things. There were two pairs of women's nylons tied in knots, a drawing of a blindfolded woman, newspaper clippings of Martha and Marita, a newspaper clipping with a photo of a coffin, paintings of angels in chains, a pair of handcuffs, another disposable jumpsuit, and a newspaper clipping of a Boy Scout's murder.
Oh, boy.
In his kitchen cupboard, they found a bra with hair on it and more newspaper clippings about Martha. As the police gathered evidence in an attempt to link Don to the missing and murdered women, because now they've kind of figured this out, the prosecutor prepared to try Don for the rape and attempted murders of Lisa and Randy. A psych eval was done on him, and it determined that he had no real mental illness, but there was a possibility he could experience a psychotic breakdown if he was under adverse stress. That's putting it lightly. Trial happened. Don was eventually found guilty of the crimes against Lisa and Randy. He was given a sentence of 30 to 50 years, and you think, oh, that's great. But back in 1979, 30 years wasn't 30 years. It meant that Don would actually only serve 20 years. And he's only 23 at this time. And he would be eligible for parole in 10 years.
What?
Which is pretty scary.
It is.
In 1979, a year later, a grand jury indicted Don for the second-degree murders of Martha and Kristen. Only those two. The prosecutor was not very confident that there was enough evidence to get a conviction in those cases. They didn't have any of those women's bodies, but those were the only cases where there was any real connection. For Kristen's, they were going to have to rely on the eyewitness testimony of someone under hypnosis.
Right.
That was really the only connection. Back at that time, there's no DNA evidence. And they really couldn't prove that Martha and Kristen were even dead.
Right, no body.
No body. As far as Wendy Bush and Marita Choquette, the prosecutor didn't feel like there was enough evidence even charged on with those crimes. But everybody knew he did it. Don continued to argue that he was a good Christian man.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't have possibly killed anyone. But you're going to like this. However, in exchange for a plea deal, he did agree to undergo hypnosis to see if it might jog his memory of the murders.
Because maybe he forgot he did
them?
Okay.
Yes, that's
okay.
Exactly what he's saying. I don't remember, but I'm willing to try. He had conditions. If somehow, while under hypnosis, it came out that he was responsible for the murders, he would agree to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter, but only for Kristen Stewart and Martha Young. He could never be charged with the murders of Wendy and Marita. Okay?
Okay.
In addition, part of the deal was that his sentence for Martha and Kristen would only be 10 years, and it would run concurrently, aka at the same time, as a sentence for Lisa and Randy's attacks. That's a long short of it. He could never be charged for two of the murders, and the other two he pleads guilty to, he's going to serve at the same time that he's already serving the sentence that he's got.
So it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, right. The family of the victims and the judge and the prosecutor agreed to the terms, but they had a condition of their own. He had 1 week to tell them what happened and to show them where the bodies were. And with that, a deal with the devil was made. Guess what happened under hypnosis? Can you guess?
He admitted to everything.
He remembered, Tanya.
Yes, he remembered.
Okay, he remembered.
He remembered everything.
Yes. His memories of the murders miraculously came flooding back to him. He revealed that he strangled his ex-fiancée Martha in the front seat of his car after she told him she didn't love him anymore. And I believe from what I could gather, he then raped her dead body.
Oh, no.
He drove her to a place called Prigorous Park in Bath, Michigan, and he dumped her next to an oak tree. A judge granted the prosecutor's request to allow Don to get out of prison and go with the police in their custody to find Martha's body. Without the help of hypnosis, Don was able to lead the authorities to her exact location. While the police examined her skeletal remains, Don picked a wildflower nearby and sang to himself.
Oh, I hate this guy.
I do too.
Hate this guy.
You gotta see pictures of him. He's just such a squirrel. As far as Marita Choquette's murder went, Don remembered under hypnosis that he'd met Marita while she was working at MSU's library, and he talked to her occasionally on the phone. Marita agreed to go out for breakfast with him one morning, the morning she disappeared. Don picked her up at her apartment, and at some point while she sat in his car, he placed handcuffs on her. He took her to those woods, and he stabbed her 17 times. He raped her somewhere in it, whether alive or dead. I'm thinking she was raped while she was alive. And the reason why I say that is because Don confesses in some of these sex offender group therapy sessions that some of his victims were raped alive and some were raped dead. And I'm assuming because she was handcuffed that would be why she would be raped alive. But I'm not a professional profiler. Eventually disposed of her body where it was found by the guy in the tractor in that whole strange formation.
The creepy altar, whatever it was.
Do you want to know why Marita's hands were cut off?
Why?
It was nothing to do with a religious or ritualistic purpose. He just couldn't get the handcuffs off her.
Oh, my God.
That's why he cut them off.
Oh, my God. He didn't want to leave them behind?
Nope. Needed those.
He needed those. Jeez.
Next, Don remembered how he killed Kristen Stewart. He saw her walking across Fair Oaks Road, and he quickly turned his car, as you know, left, and he intentionally hit her.
Oh, my God.
That quick turn caused Nancy Daniels to slam on her brakes. Don and Kristen, even though she was injured, fought in the road as he tried to drag her into his car. Under hypnosis, Don says that he thought that Kristen was Martha incarnated.
Oh, stop it.
And he said he screamed at her over and over again, "How can you still be alive?" as he stabbed her repeatedly.
Did they look alike?
A little bit. I mean,
it's bullshit.
He clearly knew it wasn't Martha.
Right.
Kristen fell unconscious from the stab wounds, but that's not what killed her. Don manually strangled her to death. It's not known if he sexually assaulted her or not. He later led authorities to a drainage ditch near Muskrat Lake, where her skeletal remains were found. An autopsy showed she had an unhealed fracture in one of her lower vertebrae, and the medical examiner said it was probably from being hit by that car, by his car. And there were faint cut marks on her third and fourth ribs. The last victim Don admitted to killing was Wendy Bush. Don claims that he'd previously met Wendy while out canoeing once. However, that can't be confirmed. What we do know is that as Wendy was walking home from the library to her Case Hall dorm room, Don stopped and offered her a ride. He was probably the guy she was talking to outside the library earlier, but again, I can't confirm it. Being that MSU's campus is a mile and a half long, I have walked it. I can let you know it's very long. It's scary at night. Wendy accepted the ride, though given her personality, she probably would have anyway. Don then pulled in the parking lot of her dorm, and the two sat in the car for about 10 minutes, talking. To Don, Wendy's flirtatious nature was viewed as seduction. It aroused some sort of resentment and anger in him, like she's a whore or something.
What the heck?
As the conversations continued, he casually put his hand on her shoulder, and then within a second or two, he put both hands around her neck and squeezed the life out of her. He said he squeezed her throat so tight that she never even got a chance to scream. After she was dead, he drove around with her body in the front seat for about 30 minutes looking for a place to dump her. He found a subdivision that was under development, and he thought that'd be a good place. So he carried her body through this small trail in the woods. And then once he dropped her body onto the ground, he removed all of her clothes, which I'm assuming he did to rape her.
That would be
because he raped women when they were dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, why else? Why else? Police were able to locate her skeletal remains exactly where Don said they should be. Now, Don Miller never showed any signs of remorse.
Well, no, he couldn't even remember doing it to Leah.
Why should he? If that's true or not.
Right.
Under hypnosis. Oh, wait, that's right. He led them to their bodies. He even claims that Martha came to him smiling in a dream.
I'm sure.
Telling him he was forgiven.
Uh-huh.
During his time in prison, as I said, Don attended sex offender support groups where he admitted to raping victims before and after their deaths. He also admitted to molesting his younger sister for years until his mother eventually intervened and made him stop. So his parents knew there was something wrong with Don.
That is just terrible.
As time passed, Don was given a firm release date of February 14th, 1999, which caused quite an uproar in the community. A group called the Committee for Community Awareness and Protection was formed with one goal in mind: to prevent the bastard's release. This group was able to get their hands on Don's prison record. And when they reviewed it, they discovered in 1994, Don had received a prison infraction for having, quote unquote, dangerous contraband.
Mm.
A guard had found a shoestring with two wooden buttons on the ends of it in Don's cell. And to the guard, it looked to be a garrote.
Okay.
The Committee for Community Awareness and Protection presented this information to the prosecutor in Chippewa County, which is where Don had been imprisoned at the time that this weapon was found. And they asked the prosecutor if he would file felony charges against Don instead of just an infraction for being in possession of a dangerous weapon. The prosecutor agreed. And the prosecutor was able to convince a jury that this shoestring with two buttons on the end, when put in the hands of an admitted strangler, became a weapon for murder. Don was found guilty and sentenced to 20 to 40 years as a habitual offender. He is scheduled to be released on May 1st of 2031 when he is 77 years old. Ironically, he will serve more time for the shoestring and buttons than he did for any of the murders he committed.
All I can do is shake my head.
Shaking my head.
At least he's still there.
Yes. I'd prefer him to be about 107 when he got out, but I guess 77. I don't know. But he's getting out then, unless they can think of something else.
Or unless he dies.
That's true.
He could.
I don't think our U.S. healthcare system in prison is very good.
So there's a chance.
Because if he gets out, I mean, Even if he doesn't offend, he's going to want to. He's got some nasty thoughts, guys. Right, he's got some nasty thoughts.
Yeah, but that doesn't go away.
So I got my information from court records. There's an awesome book by a guy named Rod Stadler called Killing Women, A True Crime. And there is so much more I did not tell you guys because it's going on and on and I can't stand this asshole anymore. I had to stop. But it's a great book. And that's it.
I had never heard this story.
I know. I didn't either. Like I said,
I mean, I've lived here all my life.
I know. And I'm going to show you a picture and you're going to tell me once we're done that he looks like a squirrel because he looks like a squirrel. He's a squirrely bastard.
Wow. Thanks for that, Leah.
That being said, are you ready for our new, what is it called?
Segment.
Yes. Our new segment. What is it again?
Review the reviewer.
Review the reviewer.
I've got one for you, Talia.
Oh, good.
This one was on Apple.
Okay.
From Babs602.
Okay.
That person gave us a 2-star review. And this person says, the crime stories are horrific and should be told in a serious manner. Unfortunately, these two stupid women giggle and cackle throughout. What's more disturbing is the two fools are attorneys. I stopped listening after 3 stories.
Wow, she made it through 3. That's great. Thanks, yeah. Babs.
I give her review a 1-star.
I give it a 1-star because it's inaccurate.
Yes.
We are not stupid.
No, we're not stupid.
You may behave stupidly.
And yes, I laugh when I'm uncomfortable.
Yes, you do. I can confirm that.
And I think we are always very respectful to the victims. I might make fun of a criminal. I might laugh over how stupid they are. And that's genuine laughter.
In general, we're not stupid. So that's why I have to agree. This is a 1-star. Sorry, Bab. You get 1-star for your stupid review.
And, you know, she probably is never going to hear this, so...
I got one for you, Tanya. This is from Hedger Earn on Apple Podcast, and this was done on March 7th. It's titled, Y'all Are Awesome.
Yay!
I prematurely judged you. I now know you're all down-to-earth women, and you're amazing.
Oh, that was nice.
I know, that was super nice. I have to give that a 5-star review.
I'm giving that a 5-star as well.
I think that Hedger Earn is an amazing person, too.
I'm glad they stuck with us.
Yes.
And found the error in their way.
Got anything else?
This one is an oldie, but...
An oldie but goodie?
Oldie but goodie. This was also on Apple Podcasts from CT99. We got a 1-star.
Oh.
Says, they don't support social injustice, so I don't support them.
Oh, shit.
I don't support social injustice.
No, I don't.
I support social justice.
Yes, I do too.
I am not a supporter of injustice in any way.
We don't normally give... a political opinion.
No, we don't.
But I am going to say, I'm going to be firm on this. We do not support social injustice.
Absolutely not.
Nope.
So I have to agree with that one.
So is it a 5-star?
I guess. In some weird way.
We don't support social injustice.
No, and shame on them for supporting social injustice.
Let's see what I got. You ready? I got one. This is from CMC Buyers, and it's Apple. Amazing. Wow. Other podcasts have been repetitive of one another, but I haven't heard 75% of your murders. 5 stars.
Yay!
Back at you with 5 stars.
Back at you. We do try to do cases that not everyone has done.
That's true. That's why they get 5 stars. Okay.
All right. Until our next segment.
I want to remind everybody to hit the subscribe/follow button if you haven't done so already. Also, you can find out more information and see the picture of Squirrely Don Miller on our website if you go to TNT Crimes. If any of you have noticed that some of our episodes aren't available on your app, it's because we put them online. They're free, but they're online only now. Also, if you want to help support us and you want ad-free, exclusive, members-only episodes, you can become a member by going to patreon.com/TNTCrimes or go to tntcrimes.com and find out more information on becoming a member. Ad-free, full,
live episodes.
So many amazing things.
Just check it out. You won't regret it.
You won't regret it. You can go to our social media, IG and Facebooks at Hardcore True Crime. And I think that's it.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Until next week.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.